Good morning and welcome back to Nachayami. Today we're going to be following through the Perek 13, Perek Yud Gimel of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. We are now at the point where Shaul is clearly established as a king. Now we're going to actually follow his kingship. It is interesting that that we have seen a lot of good about Shaul. He's been chosen by Hashem, he's been called Tov, he's better than anybody else at the time, he's head and shoulders above the rest. Now we're going to see some of the incidents which follow are going to be a little more complex. So the first thing we're told is the following, is that once he is Bereshon B'Molchoi, when he's a year into his kingship, and after 2 years of leading Israel, it's a bit of a complex pasuk. It sounds like, about a year and a bit into his kingship, this is what happens, is he has 3,000 troops who remain as his bodyguard, and he has another 1,000 who stay with Yonatan and Givat Binyamin. And now we're introduced to his son Yonatan. And we're going to see he's going to play a pivotal role in this next chapter. So what happens is that Yonatan goes ahead and assassinates an Etziv Plishtim. He assassinates one of the Plishtim governors or commanders in the local area in Geva, and the Plishtim hear about it, and this is bad news, because it sounds like even though Shaul HaMelech is the king, it sounds like the Philistines are very much in control. So that means to say, it sounds like they have their administrators in Israel territory, and Yonatan is the one to kill this particular person. So in response to this, Shaul HaMelech blows on the shofar to bring all of Israel together, all the Ivrim together, because he realizes that this is essentially a declaration of war. The word is out, and he says, "Hikol Shaul and Snetziva Plishtim." Shaul killed the governor of the Plishtim. Now, it wasn't really Shaul; it was Yonatan, but it's attributed up to his father. And Israel are scared, so they come to Shaul in Gilgal, which is of course their territory furthest from the Plishtim, which is towards the Jordan River, where the Philistines are on the coastal territory. And the Philistim, in fact, do that. They gather together with 30,000 chariots and 30,000 cavalry and 6,000 chariots. We're talking about sophisticated military equipment of the day. And they gather in Michmash, which is on the coastal plain leading up to the mountains. And Israel are pretty scared. They start hiding in the caves, among the rocks, because remember, that's the only protection, the place where the chariots, the cavalry, have less access to. That's where they start hiding. In the meantime, everybody's gathering together, and they're all rallying around Shaul. But Shaul has been told that he should wait for Shmuel Hanavi for 7 days before bringing the korban in Gilgal. And in the meantime, while he is waiting for this, with the imminent attack of the Philistines, the Israelites are dropping off. They are all sort of disappearing. And in this context, Shaul makes a decision. He decides he's going to actually bring the korban. He is not going to wait to bring the korban. And as it happens, he brings the korban to Hashem, and Shmuel walks in to give him the bracha. And Shmuel says, "What do you do?" So Shaul says, "Look, I saw the people going, and I realized if I didn't do anything to pull everybody together, we're going to lose this battle." This is the rationale he gives. Shmuel says the most terrifying statement. He says, "Because you didn't keep Hashem's mitzvahs, Hashem is going to give your kingship to somebody else. You're not going to have an infinite and extended kingdom. Your family's kingdom is not going to be established." Now, this is going to be different to what's said later, where Shaul himself loses the monarchy. This is the loss of monarchy to the family, to the base Shaul, which has happened because of this particular episode. Very sad moment. In the meantime, Shmuel actually leaves Geva, so it doesn't sound like he's actually helping in this war effort. Now he's sort of ignored. He's turned a cold shoulder on Shaul, who didn't wait for him. And now Shaul and Yonatan are left to their own devices to be able to deal with this particular battle. So in the meantime, we're told about militarily, the Philistines start breaking up into military formation. They break up into three divisions, the head and two horns, and they start surrounding the Israelites. And we're talking about a pretty serious situation over here. And in the meantime, there's an aside where the narrator of Tanakh tells us that v'charosh lo yimotzei b'chol eretz Yisrael. There are no weapons, there are no swords, there are no spears in Israel, because it was under Philistine control, and the Philistines demanded that Israel would be a demilitarized state. The only sword that they actually acquire or have is that of Shaul HaMelech and that of Yonatan. And this is the particular situation of them as they go out into the battle with the Philistines, and this ends this week's, this day's Nachyomi Perek. Just a few things to ponder, first of all, when we're looking through this. Why was it that Yonatan did this? Meaning, like, why did Yonatan go ahead with this? So the Radak says is because he realized that we would always eternally remain subservient to another nation unless we take advantage, unless we take a proactive step towards initiating war. Yonatan firmly believed that Hashem would protect them. This is interesting because if we're going to trace through the next few chapters of this story, it's important to think about initiative and lack of initiative. When is initiative all right? When is initiative not all right? Nobody ever criticizes Yonatan for attacking this Netziv Plishtim, but Shaul is criticized for taking initiative and bringing the Korban early against the command. So we have to think about that. Why is it Yonatan's initiative is deemed worthy, whereas Shaul's is not deemed worthy? That's going to be something which is worthwhile thinking. When looking at pondering the point of why, what was such a travesty in Shaul's early bringing of this Korban, we need to ask ourselves, well, what was it that he was buckling to? And it sounds like he was buckling to the pressure of the people. But more than that, it was almost as if he believed and felt that the battle couldn't be won if people were leaving him. Whereas Shmuel's perspective on things is that you win battles because Hashem helps you, not because people are there. Meaning to say, it doesn't make a difference how many people are left behind because they deserted. It really matters is if Hashem's with you or not. And that was a cardinal mistake to make in this episode. One last thing just to think about is the Radak asks, if Israel did not have any weapons, how exactly was it that they ever fought? Meaning, didn't they just destroy Ammon and Nachash in the previous parak or two parakim ago? How is it they even fought? They simply had no weapons. So Radak says, well, they weren't in the Iron Age of weapons. They weren't in the Metal Age of weapons. They were still in the Stone Age of weapons, which means that they had slingshots. They had more rudimentary weapons, which the Plishtim either could not regulate taking away or didn't feel were dangerous enough to have to take away. So this is what they used to fight with, which was certainly a military grade below what the Philistines had, and that's why the Philistines had military control in this particular era. We're going to see how this is important when it comes to David and Goliath, as we see later on in that particular fight and the difference of weaponry then. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.